Who's your favorite power couple?
Ruth and her husband.
That's a question, and I'm supposed to be pithy.
Ruth and her husband was not the answer we were looking for.
No.
We would have accepted
Sam and Martha Annalita.
Okay, all right. I will give you one. They're not my favorites, but one would be Mitch McConnell and Elaine Chao, because they had some complications that their marriage raised. Another would be more analogous to my situation, would be Andrea Mitchell and Alan Greenspan. And I think in that latter one, and I now may be running afoul of the pithiness issue, that addressed the question that I raised about the Alitos, which is, you know, something's got to give in some marriages. And sometimes, and especially in Washington, if your spouse is in a position of public office or public prominence, sometimes there's things that you don't do that you would otherwise be doing.
This is Impromptu from Washington Post Opinions. It's a podcast where we bring you a conversation our columnists are having about the biggest issues on their minds. Over the last few weeks, yet another Supreme Court ethics controversy has been unfolding. This one having to do with Justice Samuel Alito and the flags that he says his wife raised outside their homes in the aftermath of January 6, 2021. He's denied he was involved and won't recuse himself because of this from any Supreme Court cases. It all raises questions about what it means to be married to a Supreme Court justice, or really any powerful figure where there's an expectation that that power will be wielded ethically and neutrally. And then there's the bigger issue of the Supreme Court seemingly becoming more political, more embroiled in partisan controversies, and whether anyone can or should hold them to account. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinions Editor, and two of my colleagues are here to get into all of this. Would you introduce yourselves?
I'm James Holman.
And I'm Ruth Marcus.
What did you think about Justice Alito's rationale that this flag at his house in suburban Virginia was all his wife's doing, and that she's allowed to speak her mind and do what she wants as a private citizen? Let's start with you, James.
I thought there was some irony in Justice Alito, who wrote the Dobbs decision, saying that a woman should get to choose what to do with her flag at her jointly owned house. But obviously, flying the flag upside down is incredibly inadvisable. I mean, Justice Alito says that he asked her to take the flag down and she refused. If that's true, and that is an if, that does give him some cover. If he said, take this down, that's an accommodation that she's not making. On the vacation home in New Jersey, it's actually, he pointed out, in her name. She bought it with money that she inherited from her parents. And I think it's a terrible look. And I think it does raise questions about his jurisprudence. But that does hold some water, and you do need to give it some credit.
Ruth, your column didn't suggest that you would agree with James on those points, but I'm going to give you a chance to respond to what he just said.
I think that the notion that Mrs. Alito is free to do whatever she wants and she has her own autonomous ability to do that is technically correct, but fundamentally misapprehends, first of all, the way marriages should work in general. Second of all, the way what I call Washington marriage should work. And by a Washington marriage, I mean where somebody, one or two of the people in the marriage, are in a position of public office or public prominence. And the notion that her marital rights and behavior and that his ability to persuade her were based on the ownership structure and property law of their arrangement, that it was a joint tenancy in Virginia, so he had no recourse, he said, to deal with her, and that the New Jersey property is owned by her outright, so he certainly can't control her there. That's not the way, actually, my marriage works, and it's not the way I think most of our marriages work. We are respectful, or we try to be, of the needs of our spouses. So I wrote that my husband had been in government. When he was in government, I did not write about things that he was involved in, both to respect his independence and to respect my journalistic needs. And simultaneously, while he's active in politics and makes political contributions in his own name, he doesn't put up lawn signs at her house, so it doesn't reflect on me or give people the wrong impression of my views. And I'm not holding up our marriage as, you know, storybook picture perfect, but it's just like a basic marriage that works because we respect each other's needs. And I think the notion that Justice Alito asked his wife to take down the flag and it took several days for her to accede to his wishes or to get it out of her system is astonishing, number one. And number two, the thing that's mostly interesting about that is his basically instant recognition that this was a problem. And so therefore, when other people have a problem with it 3 years after the fact, when we learn about it, he shouldn't have any complaints about that. It was a problem.
I guess what Ruth is getting at, James, is something like, you know, the person whose impartiality could be misconstrued or construed negatively is kind of owed by the other partners a little bit of deference. I mean, do you agree with that? Or, you know, remember Martha Mitchell and John Mitchell during Watergate? Martha Mitchell sure didn't defer to her husband, the attorney general, and we were all kind of happy about that.
Nor did George Conway defer to Kellyanne.
Yes. And
what happened to them? I can't remember.
You know, I think that, yes. I mean, the only two people who know what's going on inside a marriage are the two people in a marriage.
Well, in my case, neither of us knows what's going on. But
I mean, I'm happy that my wife is a journalist. You know, it has the same kinds of concerns.
Yes.
But I do think that it is a basic respect thing. And if you take Justice Alito at his word, which I don't necessarily, she just flatly wouldn't take down the flag. I do think that creates an appearance that he can't be impartial. It is really problematic. But ultimately, you have to defer, as we always have, to the justices on whether they can approach a case impartially. And Justice Alito says he can, however partisan his voting record and however much he seems like a politician in a black robe. You have to respect that as part of the rule of law.
Ruth, coming back to you, there's a little difference here between the sort of Jenny Thomas, Clarence Thomas thing, which is like this ongoing deal, right, where Jenny Thomas has been active in politics or whatever it is for like years. And this one, which feels much more like sort of a spur-of-the-moment flare-up, right, that this flag hoisting begins in the heat of a neighborhood battle between the Alitos and their neighbors who are obviously don't agree with them politically. Do you think that makes any difference in how we judge this?
It does make a difference. I think the Jenny Thomas thing, and I've tried to be really cognizant of this over the years of paying attention to her political career. Her career, which she's entitled to have, is as a conservative activist. And her views should not be automatically imputed to her husband, nor should we expect her to simply give up her career once he takes the job. But accommodations can flow in both directions. People have stopped practicing before the court or stopped being active as lawyers in order to accommodate their husband's needs. I'm thinking about Jane Roberts, the wife of the Chief Justice. If in the Jenny Thomas situation, if she wants to continue to be a conservative activist, there may be some situations, and I think we've found them, in which it may be incumbent on her husband, if she continues to do that, to recuse himself from the cases. And I think much more than in the case of the Alitos, it is or was, before he decided not to do it, incumbent on Justice Thomas to recuse himself from the January 6th related cases where her involvement in that issue is so clear cut. If she wanted to do that, then something's got to give and things can give on both sides.
Putting all the spousal stuff off to one side, do you think that Supreme Court justices are like more outwardly partisan now than they were 20, 25 years ago? James?
No. Historically, we had former elected officials on the court, and I think that there actually was some value in that as opposed to a bunch of academic lawyers. when you had Earl Warren, who had been governor of California, had been understood the partisan politics, understood how some of their decisions would play and the struggles to implement them. I think that that probably was better for the court. But definitely compared to pre-Bush v. Gore, the court seems more partisan. And I do think that that's problematic. I also think it's problematic that the media has persisted in pretending that the court is completely above partisanship for so long. The coverage has obviously shifted kind of pre and post Dobbs, but of course they're individuals and they should be covered as such rather than sort of some kind of saintly figure.
Yeah. And I would say that 20 to 25 years is probably the wrong time span to look at. Look back at the degree to which Supreme Court justices were involved with the White House during the New Deal. Look at the degree to which Abe Fortas was back and forth chatting with Lyndon Johnson.
How did that one end?
Touche.
Not very well for either of them.
No, I think there's been a lot of behind the scenes political involvement by justices that we would now deem improper. Historically, that does not make the current degree of partisanship not itself improper.
So I used to cover the court. That's now almost 20 years ago. But the takeaway from the experience of covering that court and some of the lower federal courts I found was the higher you go in the federal system, the more partisan the jurist. And the logic for that is pretty simple. First of all, not only are the stakes always the highest at the Supreme Court, but they've been getting higher and higher the more issues we are kind of shunting off out of the legislature and into the courts, number one. And number two, come on, if the stakes are high and your party controls the Senate and the presidency, you want to make darn sure you have somebody reliable in there. And so no more suitors, exactly. And no more Breyers right. Now is kind of a Democratic cry. So, you know, unfortunately, notwithstanding the fact that we really need somebody up there who's perceived as impartial and willing to, you know, vote against his or her party from time to time, the incentives that the parties have to produce people like that have probably never been lower. But anyway.
So your answer would be yes.
My answer, well, they're not more outwardly partisan necessarily, but the way they actually behave on the court is much more reliable to the parties that put them there.
I think you're may partly, Chuck, if I may, be conflating partisanship and ideology. And the thing that has changed in the last 20 to 25 years, maybe a little bit longer than that, is the complete identification of ideological point of view with political party as a driving force in making nominations. So as Republicans declare no more suitors and Democrats also make sure that they pick people who are ideologically compatible, you have the court sorted out along ideological lines much more clearly than it ever has been before. And that itself aligns quite perfectly and not coincidentally with the party's partisan views in most cases.
Point very well made. And I would just add, I think in terms of the outward stuff, the justices are much looser, let's say, about the appearances of where and when and to whom they give public speeches and statements. I mean, the idea that justices are, you know, talking to the Federalist Society, which is sort of like, you know, a Republican activist organization for all intents and purposes, if they're conservative, but would never dream of doing it if they're liberals. I'm sure there are exceptions, but you guys get the point, is that their statements in public now are much more right up to the line of being openly partisan. I think Sonia Sotomayor just said the other day about how she cries when she reads some of the rulings of the court. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. It's not exactly partisan, but it's sort of revealing an emotional stake in the outcome that is.
Yeah, I did not find that a partisan statement. It did highlight the importance of the outcomes. And I would say that I think this is objectively true, that and with the exception of Justice Ginsburg, who is really open to some criticism here, I think that the conservative justices have been much more guilty or tending to favor partisan audiences than the liberal justices have been, at least recently. And I'm thinking, for example, of them all trooping to the McConnell Center after McConnell got them on the court.
Maybe it just seems like the conservatives are doing it more because there's no liberals left.
There's twice as many.
Also a fair point.
I want to talk more broadly about checks and balances, ethics, recusal rules, all that good stuff. But let's take a break first.
Hey, I'm Jason Pfeiffer, editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
And I'm money expert Nicole Lapin. I think we're all sick of hearing we're in unprecedented times and there's this new normal. But the truth is, things in the workplace are changing.
And with change comes opportunity, but you have to know where to look, which is why on our podcast, Help Wanted, we are helping you find those opportunities before anyone else and answering your big work questions.
Listen to Help Wanted wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Charles Lane, and this is Impromptu. So there's a special way that ethics work at the Supreme Court having to do with judicial recusals. Ruth, what does it take, sort of both on paper and in the real world, for a justice to decide to recuse, which just for the record means to not take part in a case when they otherwise would have? And should Sam Alito do that in the January 6th related immunity case or any others this term?
So there are two sets of rules. One is an actual law. It's a federal law that says any judge, including a Supreme Court justice, it explicitly applies to Supreme Court justices, shall recuse if his or her impartiality can reasonably be questioned. There is also this ethics code that we've heard a lot about that the Supreme Court set out for itself, where it makes clear that individual recusal decisions are up to the justice, him or herself, that justices should kind of put a thumb on the scale against recusal if they can possibly sit. The reason for that, I think, is legitimate because, unlike in the lower federal courts, if an appeals court judge can't sit in a case or a district court judge can't sit in a case, it's easy to find a replacement. There's no replacement in our current arrangement for Supreme Court justices. So you create, if somebody recuses, the possibility of a 4-4 split and things like that. And that's not healthy. All of that said, I think, and I would distinguish this from the Thomas case, where I do think he should recuse from the January 6th related cases because of his wife's involvement. I think, and this has upset many of my liberal friends, and they really vehemently disagree with me, but I think if you accept the notion that justices should be reluctant to recuse themselves, I don't think this one rises to the level. Her actions are ambiguous. I have questions about his impartiality and whether it can be reasonably questioned in every single darn case that he sits on. he is not my model justice, but I'm not sure that I think her actions in this case are so beyond the pale and so immutably imputed to him that he needs to recuse himself. And I know I've just raised a lot of people's blood pressure.
Justice Alito should surprise everyone and make the correct legal constitutional decisions in the January 6th cases.
He should sit, but rule against Trump's interests. Yeah.
I'm going to come back and ask how that one's working out.
Yeah.
It might be, to use a George H.W. Bush word, it might be prudent for him to recuse because it would very much help public support and confidence in the court. I just don't think it's incumbent on him.
And they don't need his vote. I mean, they won't need his vote on any of these. We'll find out. But
yeah, I mean, that's one thing that has always left me a little cold about these arguments about Thomas and Alito recusing is that I'm not sure in the end how much difference it would make. I mean, a lot of Democrats are very happy to keep making this argument because, let's face it, it's kind of good for fundraising and it's a great cause for their base. I mean, looking ahead, you know, this sort of never-ending kerfuffle about the court, its ethics, whether it has too much power, whether it's consistent, follows precedent, whatever. you know, raises the question of whether it can be structurally reformed, whether there are things we need to do, or there's a scenario under which the public loses so much confidence in the court because it seems political that Congress or some other agency, a constitutional amendment we've brought to bear. Any chance you see of that, Ruth?
No.
I think talk about it is dangerous. That sounded bad, but the people who are saying, let's pack the court, let's blow up the filibuster, let's impeach the justices. If
we blew up the filibuster.
We not for legislation. And I do think that the tit for tat, the escalation in some of the rhetoric about the court is ultimately, and I'm not trying to blame the Democrats at all, because I do think at the very least, Alito has behaved poorly. I think the Clarence Thomas case for recusal is much clearer. But I think in some ways, the attacks on the court have contributed to undermining the legitimacy that many people in the Senate say they're trying to protect.
That's a little bit blaming the victim.
That's what I was going to say. I don't want to blame the victim.
It's a little bit buying into the Republican argument that these attacks on the court are simply invented and fanned solely for the purpose of undermining the legitimacy of the court. I don't think that that's true. I was critical of Justice Ginsburg when she made comments about not yet President Trump. I have been very critical of Justice Thomas and Justice Alito on the trips that they took, not because I disagree with their rulings, though I do tend to disagree with almost all of their rulings, but because I thought they were sloppy, irresponsible, and basically unethical in accepting these kinds of gifts from people, separate and apart from partisanship. And so I think that while certainly there is politics afoot on both sides of this, and I think that some of the critics of the court have gone too far in arguing for court expansion and things like that, I would not blame them for raising issues that are of the creation of the conservative justices.
So my favorite reforms, one would be to make the court less important. And one way to do that would be to have Congress write its statutes a little more clearly and so on. And, you know, just sort of lower the stakes involved in what kinds of issues come to the court. That's a little more quixotic. I think slightly less quixotic is the idea of limiting the terms of the court. A lot of people have talked about, instead of it being a life tenured position, an 18-year position. And, you know, then when you go to the Senate to confirm somebody, you at least have the sense like they won't be there forever. And so it's not World War III every time we have a nomination process. But of course, I'm not going to let you two respond to that point because we're running out of time. But I did want to give each of you an opportunity to just say, what is your takeaway from the great affair of the flag, James?
The upside-down American flag is a lot more problematic to me than the appeal to heaven flag. This is a long history in the United States of symbols, flags, objects being twisted to represent something that I don't think that it was intended to represent. The pine tree on the appeal to heaven flag symbolized strength and resilience.
This is the one she had at the vacation home.
This is the New Jersey place. Yeah. The pine tree on the flag symbolized strength and resilience in the New England colonies, and the words appeal to heaven stemmed from the belief that God would deliver the colonists from tyranny. I understand that some of the January 6th folks had it, but I don't think that you can necessarily impute that that was what Martha Ann Alito was trying to do. Until last week, it was flying outside San Francisco City Hall on a flagpole and had been for decades. So I'm much less bothered by that, and I don't like the tenor of the coverage that suggests that that's somehow has become white supremacist or anything like that. But the upside down American flag is problematic. And I also really don't like that, for example, the Heritage Foundation, they flew their flag upside down the day after the Trump verdict last week as sort of a call for distress. We saw it during the Tea Party movement. We've seen it from the left. I don't like when people do that.
I would add a point about the disingenuousness, if not outright dishonesty, of Justice Alito in all of this that I think is worth paying attention to. Justice Alito told us initially that the flag flew briefly. He told Fox News that it flew for a short time. It turned out when it was reported by the Washington Post, good for us, and it was necessary to come cleaner on that, that the flag flew for 4 days, I think was what he copped to. And so he just simply has not been straightforward about what has happened here, and I think that goes on his permanent record with me.
Great, Ruth. Thank you very much. I hope you've wiped my permanent record clean, although I don't know what would be on there.
I don't know, but I don't have the pardon power, Chuck.
James does not have a permanent record. Okay, we've got to wrap it up, but I want to thank both of you for being with me and our audience for another episode of Impromptu.
See you guys.
Bye, Ruth.
This episode was produced by Hadley Robinson, edited by Damir Marusik, Chris Sullentrop and Allison Michaels, and mixed by Emma Munger. Chris Rukan designed our art. Special thanks to Millie Mitra, Nick Safin, Renita Jablonski, and David Shipley. Thanks for listening to Impromptu. Help us get the word out about our podcast. You can do that by telling your friends or leaving us a review. And feel free to reach out to us directly to share your thoughts on this episode or any episode of Impromptu. Email us a voice memo at impromptu@washpost.com.
Hey, I'm Christina Quinn, the host of Try This from The Washington Post. Each Try This audio course gets you closer to solving some of the biggest everyday challenges we face as humans. Things like how to sleep better, how to have more meaningful relationships, and how to enjoy cooking more. We're releasing new courses all the time, where you can learn to be a better functioning human without the time commitment. Find our collection of courses by searching Try This wherever you listen to podcasts.